Hello and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy, where we strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. In addition to featuring unique conversation and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Step inside, take a seat, let's explore the world of therapy like never before. Dr. Eli's here, bringing voices so bright, innovating, relating, and shedding new light. It's AAMFT, where wisdom meets passion. Come listen and see, talking trends, deep insights, and stories so bold. For MFT minds, the future unfolds. Systemic, my friends, we relate, educate, and innovate again. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. We relate, educate, and innovate again, one episode at a time. At a time. One episode at a time.
Have you ever worked with couples with fundamental differences in how their respective brains work? One partner is neurotypical, while the other is an ADHDer. Maybe they're on the spectrum, what we now know as neurodiverse. Initially, opposites may attract, and these members of a couple may be drawn to each other because of these differences. The neurotypical may be attracted to their partner's creativity, intelligence. The neurodiverse partner may appreciate the neurotypical's helping him or her navigate social situations. They view themselves as complementary, like a perfect fit. But eventually, as we see in many relationships, these differences turn into annoyances. So it's easy for these neurological differences to lead to wires getting crossed, which makes it harder to build and maintain an emotional connection in the context of a committed long-term relationship. When couples realize they have a disparity in how they think and experience emotion, they need tools, because without the tools to understand and constructively deal with neurodiversity, these differences are often interpreted negatively, which over time become dysfunctional patterns, can erode trust. They can cause one or both partners to pursue, withdraw, lead to blame, shame, feelings of hopelessness and disappointment and loneliness, can infect your sex life and making things that need to be shared, like parenting and sharing household labor and finances, much more difficult. Today on the podcast, we address this work of neurodiverse couples with our guest and expert, Kelly Mercado Willard. Written from Mercado Willard's unique perspective as a neurodivergent couple therapist herself, her new book, Brain-Informed Neurodiverse Couple Therapy, addresses this pivotal knowledge gap we have in the couples therapy field right now and helps systemic therapists like you, our listener, develop and maintain ethical standards of care for working with neurodiverse couples. The book also introduces a new style of couple therapy, brain-informed neurodiverse couple therapy. Kelly will tell us all about that. She begins by providing some historical context and psychoeducation around neurodiversity before offering important training tips on best practices, assessment, treatment planning, using non-ableist practical interventions for neurodiverse couples. Kelly writes from a firsthand experience being neurodivergent herself and runs her own therapy practice and consulting called Love All the Brains out of Georgia. She's a self-identified gifted ADHDer with sensory processing differences and other colorful brain qualities. Her current focus has recently shifted away from working directly with clients and instead towards training and advocating for therapists who are working with neurodiverse populations. Kelly dreams of a world where competent, compassionate, pro-neurodiversity professionals are readily available for all those who need that support. Kelly holds her MA in Marriage and Family Therapy from Richmond Graduate University with a specialization in Christian sex therapy. She is a clinical fellow of the AAMFT and an LMFT in the state of Georgia. I greatly appreciate Kelly's knowledge and passion around this area, and I know you will too. We will be back after our interview with Kelly Mercado Willard. Eli, back with you on the AAMFT podcast. I am so happy to be joined by Kelly Mercado Willard, and today we are talking about neurodiverse couple therapy. And Kelly has a great book on that we'll mention today. And she is an LMFT, as you heard me say in the open. And Kelly, the first question we always ask our experts is we like to know their therapeutic origin story. How'd you get into systemic couple and family therapy? And then how did you get interested in working with neurodiversity and neurodiverse couples?
As a neurodivergent person myself, who only became aware of that in my late 30s, I was appalled. That was a very common story, especially for women, that we don't know this fundamental part of our identity, this fundamental part of ourselves until later, at least if you were born in the 80s like me. That is a narrative that is changing, and I'm very happy to see that changing for this younger generation of people being more early identified and hopefully able to think about what that means for their lives at an earlier age than what I was afforded. But I had always, from a young age, been very interested in people. You could call it a special interest. And people and animals, but people ended up winning out. Let's be real. I am an ADHDer. It was people, animals, and music. Those were my top three. And I did pursue each of those. But in the end, psychology won out. I went to work for the Social Security Administration and became very easily disillusioned with the fact that I was not working on a deeper level. So that led me to pursue counseling. And individuals were a bit boring for me. So I thought, couples, there we go. I really want to work with couples. And when I worked with couples, I was a Christian sex therapist. And that was amazing. And then I birthed two children of my own that were neurodivergent. I came to understand my own neurodivergence. And I thought, this is it. Who is out there for people like us? I was already a specialist, but then I became a mega specialist, basically. And neurodiverse couples were so fascinating and so amazing to work with that I never went back.
I imagine the majority of our listeners have heard that term, neurodivergence, and the reverse of that, neurotypical. But let's, for those that have it, why don't you define that?
Neurotypical can be thought of as a brain that processes incoming information in a similar way to the majority. And that includes sensory information, that includes how someone reads, it includes a lot of things. And so that would be a profile of a sort of a typical learner. There may be some differences within that. Obviously, no two neurotypical people are exactly the same. But there can be wild differences in neurodivergent brains in how someone is detecting, interpreting, organizing stimuli. That is a biologically different process for neurodivergent individuals than most neurotypical people. No two neurodivergent people are the same either. We are all different, but there is a vast statistically important difference between a neurotypical brain and a neurodivergent brain. Neurodivergence can be anything from autism, ADHD, dyslexia, et cetera. And there are some sort of controversial, overlapping kind of questions about something like bipolar, example. There's a lot of question about what qualifies as an illness versus a disorder, et cetera. For people like me who are part of the neuroaffirming neurodiversity movement, we really dislike terms like disorder. I call myself an ADHDer because that is my diagnosis, and there's not a better term for it. But I think every day that is such a misnomer. I don't have a lack of attention. I have so much attention on all the things at all the time and so much intensity. And it's such a negative interpretation to call this a disorder. But that is not to say that it is not disabling at times. It is not to say that there is not quite a level of distress at times. How much of that is from a world that doesn't understand people like me and our brains and doesn't accommodate us? And how much of that is from actually the sensory dysfunction that I experience? And I'm okay with calling it dysfunction because there are certainly times where it is unpleasant, where I can read a sensation as pain. And that's not pleasant to me. But there are other times where I can feel music in my bones, and I would not give that up for the world. So there's so much about neurodivergence that is complex. And I would love for the therapy community to understand that on a deeper level so that we can start to view our clients from a different lens and help them see themselves and their relationships from that lens.
Yes, so well said. I agree that in our profession, one of the reasons I chose MFT after having a background in clinical psychology, which was deficit and pathology based, is the ability to see strength and health. And why I like the term neurodivergence is because, I've worked with so many wonderfully talented and skilled clients whose brain just works differently. They have amazing strengths and compensatory strategies that if you just labeled it as dysfunction, it would certainly not only pathologize them, but really not do justice to the really remarkable alternate kind of ways of thinking and processing that they have. It's important that therapists understand in order to psychoeducate. So we're going to talk about that in a second. But first, I wanted you to mention brain-informed care. And what do you mean by that?
Brain-informed care is really an atmosphere of care, similar to trauma-informed care. That's what inspired me to create this phrase of brain-informed, because much like trauma-informed care creates an atmosphere of understanding, and it's a lens from which to view your client, that's what I mean when I say brain-informed. Because biologically, there is a reality that we all come from a different neurological home base. And so if we have, as therapists, an understanding and education about what those biological differences are and how that affects a neurodivergent person's lived experience, where they may have a greater frequency of challenge, greater intensity of challenge, greater duration of challenge, greater levels of stress, greater propensity to emotional dysregulation, communication differences, a higher potential for trauma in their childhood and even adulthood, higher propensity towards interpersonal violence, sexual assault, etc. If we can understand that and that not be something that we are completely blind to, it really opens up the therapeutic alliance to be built on validation of that person's lived experience in a way that is similar to trauma-informed care, where you would never treat someone who has a trauma background as if they didn't have a trauma background. We have an understanding that their neurobiology has been made different or affected by their experience. And in a neurodivergent person, they may have trauma, yes, and frequently they do, but they were born into a world that was not designed for them. Their biology came into the world differently, and they may or may not have even had a personal awareness of that difference until much later in life. And they may not come into your office knowing their differences even. They may just have a lot of stress or confusion, or perhaps their ADHD or their dyslexia is an enemy to them. They see it as an obstacle. But the point is that the therapist is coming into the room already with education and understanding that provides a holding environment for this person to sort through labels, identity, concerns, processing issues, and how it impacts their relationship. This is not something that the client is having the burden of teaching, although we are all students to our clients' lived experience. Obviously, we need to take that not knowing stance and be educated. But the point is that the client does not have the burden of teaching the therapist what ADHD is. The therapist needs to really have a firm understanding of what potentially different neurological home bases can be and look like without making assumptions. We really do need to understand the complexity, but every therapist needs to have these basic understandings of the 8, not 5, 8 sensory systems, what executive functioning looks like, the strain that it can put on a person if the executive functioning systems have challenges, what it means to live in a world of readers when dyslexia is present and reading is so difficult. There's so much that a therapist can bring to the atmosphere of brain-informed care that lightens the load for our clients and gives a profound level of understanding.
Yes, hard to argue with that. Now, specifically around couples, how do you think knowledge about neurodiversity can help couples? And then what you consider, what is the essential psychoeducation that every couples therapist should know about neurodiversity?
Every couples therapist should know about the 8 sensory systems: vestibular, interoceptive, proprioceptive, tactile, auditory, gustatory, olfactory, vision. We need to understand where in the brain these systems are processed. We need to understand what happens if the systems' wirings are crossed at times. We need to understand that if someone is telling you that the lights are too bright in your office, that may be actually causing a physical sensation of pain or level of distraction that is not only important to validate and support, but it's important to then use that moment to talk about the fact that sensory security is important to you as a therapist in order to provide them, because it's important as a foundation for their connection to the experience, connection to the therapeutic alliance, connection to their partner. If partners are not understanding each other on this neurological home-based level, and if one partner is always telling the other, for example, and very simply, you can't be cold, the thermostat is set at 74 here. 74 is 74. How are you saying you're cold? That's rude and invalidating, yes, but it goes beyond that. It's saying that my standard of 74 is better than your standard. You couldn't possibly experience 74 degrees differently than me. And that is ableist. That is, I said rude. Yes, it is rude. Yes, it is invalidating. But think about that on the many levels of communications that couple has. It's not just about the frequent temperature arguments that couples have within their home. That was a silly example. But if two people are not willing to put in the work to understand where the other person is coming from, how they're processing information, how long it takes them to process information. Sometimes people can be very quick processing. Other times people need time to really chew on information and formulate a response back. That person might not be shutting down at all. They may just be taking time to formulate a response. Couples often don't tolerate silence in a relationship unless they're both very conflict avoiding. So we need to be able to encourage couples to have a want and a desire to understand their own brain and how their partner, and then to understand their relationship to their own brain and their relationship to their partner's brain. Does the fact that your partner needs extra processing time annoy you? Are you interpreting that as rejection? Are you interpreting that as a negative thing? It can be very transformative for this fictional couple where they're having differences in processing time. It can be very transformative to just reframe and think, what if that partner who's taking too long to answer you is, what if they're not going silent to be rejecting? What if they're taking the time to be able to show up fully within the relationship? And what if you had patience to give your partner what they need? I'm pretty sure that will return to you tenfold if you lead with empathy, and vice versa. The other person may be taught the skill of verbalizing or writing down or texting, what you said is important. I'd like some time to think before I answer. Just giving that immediacy can be a win. And something so simple can be such a helpful support for a couple that's gotten stuck on something like that.
I'm thinking as you were talking, I have worked with members of a dyad, a couple in therapy, where both are neurodivergent. And one would think, oh, that could be very challenging. But in some ways, because they have understanding that their brain works differently and so does their partner, there is a more of a empathy, a space to understand difference. Whereas many times I think you see a neurodivergent partner paired with a neurotypical partner. What is your experiences on the differences if you're working with both members that are neurodivergent versus one member of the couple that's neurodivergent and the other is neurotypical?
So honestly, what I see is the biggest marker of success with any combination of couple, neurodiverse, meaning one is neurotypical and one is neurodivergent. That's the most common use of that term, neurodiverse couple. Although you can also use the term neurodiverse couple for two neurodivergent people, because again, no two neurodivergent people are going to be the same. And there's quite an array of ways to be a human. And human brains are unique as fingerprints, and we need an understanding of that. But what I see is the biggest marker of success is the attitude that one takes toward the stance of empathy. Whether it's a neurotypical person with a neurodivergent person or two neurodivergent people, we have to have the understanding that our partner is coming from a very different neurological base, that their processing, their energy level, what is safe and healthy and reads as interesting or just has access to the skills, for example, is going to be different. And so if that attitude is there, if the willingness to develop empathy is there, it doesn't matter the combination of brain types. And there is something that is amazing to read about. It's called the double empathy problem. And this was specifically made, I believe, by Milton, put into words to talk about how humans have a propensity to think that the person sitting next to them is experiencing the stimuli in front of them in the same way. Whether it's an autistic person or whether it's a neurotypical person, they're going to probably assume that if a little kitten walks in the room, the person next to them is seeing the same cat, if they're both sighted people, possibly smelling the same smell from the cat. We're going to assume that the stimuli in the room is going to be perceived the same way. Now, an autistic person with very high levels of understanding about themselves, it's probably actually pretty acutely aware that the neurotypical person next to them is going to be a little different. We have a lot of insight a lot of times when we're neurodivergent. So I don't want to undercut that. But I'm just saying that the double empathy problem means that we just tend to not understand that somebody else can see something different. And we tend to assume that our way is the right way. And so we need to understand that this is a problem specifically with neurotypical people married to neurodivergent people. Because we live in the neurotypical majority, there tends to be a lot of misunderstanding on the part of the neurotypical person that their neurodivergent partner is seeing or feeling 74 degrees differently. And so that tends to be a stumbling block for many of the couples. And in the literature, that tends to be a stumbling point in the statistics about conflict and divorce rates, et cetera, for neurodiverse couples where there's an NT, neurotypical, with a neurodiverse partner. You tend to see some really interesting stats now about neurodivergent people with neurodivergent people. Those couples are doing pretty well. And you might think, oh, they're both neurodivergent. They have this innate understanding. No, there's still empathy problems there, but it's something interesting perhaps about both being minority in the world that is not meant for them. There could be something there. I'd like to see the research more about why that is. Or maybe it's just, I don't know, two ADHD people are pretty fun. Maybe there's just some intensity of interests there that they're bonded over. Maybe there's intellectual intimacy perhaps that's happening in a different way. I'm not really sure, but it is very interesting to see.
As an ADHD person myself, I was a product of the late 70s. So growing up, if you did well in school and had parents that supported me and a brother that was really sharp, so I didn't get my ADHD detected in school. It was later in my doctoral training, I went through everything. And that was very helpful for my partner then at the time, now my wife, in the sense that a lot of my behaviors, my rapid speech, jumping, sometimes interrupting my wife really, because she was very neurotypical, felt like that was very disruptive and rude. But getting the diagnosis was very helpful at that part in our relationship. So a lot of times, though, in couples therapy, we'll see two scenarios. One, there is no diagnosis, and these things look to a neuro typical partner. They look like annoyances, or again, this lack of empathy, as you say, or just a selfish or careless spouse or significant other. So we have that. And then we also have, hey, I know you got diagnosed with ADHD, but you use this as your get out of jail card free for everything. People that have ADHD, they still participate in the household chores, helping raise the kids. So a lot of partners then are still, even with a diagnosis, not as accepting of their partner's neurodivergent differences. How would you work with a partner like that to get their buy-in to do the couple's work? And then we'll talk about the structure of neurodivergent couple therapy. But how do you work with people that really have a hard time buying in to their neurodivergent partner's way of looking at the world?
This is very common. It's every couple I see. It's so common. And typically in that type of dynamic, not always, but typically, it goes a little deeper than just starting out by educating the difference between Gottman's term of a complaint versus a criticism. It's perfectly okay to complain and say, I would really like your help with this task. And it's been a week and I've been asking and you haven't completed this task. I'm speaking neurotypical to neurodivergent, being a little stereotypical there for just a minute, but that is a very common dynamic where the neurodivergent person who perhaps has less access to executive functioning processing in that moment, or maybe has fewer spoons. I hope everyone is familiar with the spoon theory. That is an excellent model to use with couples.
Actually, could you explain the spoon theory?
If a person is having trouble completing the task that a neurotypical partner has asked of them, for example, just to stick with our original premise here of the therapy scenario that you offered, perhaps they are low on spoons that week. Perhaps it is something that they don't have the energy for. And when I refer to spoons, this is not a theory that I came up with. This is a woman named Christine explaining actually to a friend her experience of chronic illness. And so this is not necessarily a neurodiversity term, but it lends itself so beautifully. And there's such overlap within the chronic illness community and the neurodivergent community. These conditions really co-occur so frequently that we've borrowed it. And it's really simply using spoons as units of energy. And a neurotypical person without a chronic illness is going to wake up with more spoons at the beginning of the day than a neurodivergent person, especially a neurodivergent person with chronic illness. And let's say you're, the NT person is taking a shower and getting ready for work, and perhaps they actually get a few spoons added because the shower felt pleasant and it energized them and they are now ready for their day, and they've actually added to the spoons that they got after a good night's sleep. Let's say our neurodivergent friend has woken up after not a great level of sleep, and so their spoons are low to begin with there. Perhaps they're having a flare of their chronic illness. They've got a little extra brain fog. Maybe they were not able to refill their ADHD medication the day before, and so they're operating without their medication support that morning. They are going to take a shower, and it is just difficult on a sensory level. Perhaps the water doesn't hit them correctly. The temperature is not quite right. And maybe it just physically exhausts them because of their physicality that day. So they're leaving the shower not energized. They're actually depleted on top of the lack of sleep depletion, on top of the lack of medication depletion. They're starting that day very differently. And let's say it's day three of the neurotypical partner asking them to make that phone call to the insurance company or something that is not as simple if you have executive functioning differences, is not as simple as just find the phone number and call and sit and listen to the waiting music. There are probably about 15 steps, actually, if you really break down that task from locating the number to dialing the number. And really, you can get very specific with these things, and they all take a toll on the brain. It is not as simple as think of task, do the task. For a neurodivergent brain, there are 100 different ways that the wiring can be crossed. And if you don't have the energy to face the task and to juggle all of the decision fatigue that is under the surface to a quote-unquote simple task, And then on top of it, your neurotypical partner is going to call you lazy or uncaring. That is also extremely invalidating and depleting. Maybe you're also telling yourself that you're lazy. Oh, why can't I do this simple thing? So when you start to enlighten the couple about all the underpinnings of the neurological home bases that are going on, all the assumptions that are being made about what should be easy, what is not acceptable as a partner, when you start taking the defensiveness out of it, if they loved me, they would show up for me in this way. We really have to reframe so much with these couples to say, what if he or she, who's an ADHDer, loves you so much, and yet they still struggle to complete these tasks? What if the lack of completion of this task is not related to their level of love for you, their level of care for the relationship, or even their desire to do the task? So often, the ADHD or the neurodivergent person wants to do the thing. They want to succeed. They want to please the partner. They want to shed these old shameful labels of character flaws, of lazy, all the things that they've been told their whole life or they've felt and internalized their whole life. They want to excel, but things are stacked against them. The executive functioning drain is real and heavy, and they're perhaps lacking the skills to be able to excel. They're not aware of their brain. They're not aware of the strategies in order to work with their brain instead of against it. And the partner is being critical instead of just complaining in healthy ways. They're doing the Gottman criticism that goes to character attack versus trying to partner and support. And I teach my couple to ask each other things about, hey, how many spoons do you have today? Or where are your spoons today? Do you have the spoons to do this today? Could you do this for me today? I've gotten this started for you. Could you finish it? So many times the neurotypical person is just making a request and then assuming the partner, if they loved them enough, would do it.
So now you got me interested in thinking like, okay, what is a structure in a format of a neurodiverse brain-informed care couples therapy session going to look like? Because it would seem like, first of all, the neurodivergent member of the couple has to have some self-awareness to how their brain works before they can educate the therapist, and then the therapist can facilitate a softening, if we're using Gottman's terms or EFT language, a softening toward the neurotypical spouse that is pretty blaming and frustrated. So talk about the structure and the format of a neurodiverse couples therapy session.
So much of this, of course, depends on where the couple is. Any good therapist knows that there could be a couple that is claiming and waving the flag for neurodiversity. And that is going to be very different than a couple coming in with high stress and all of these traumas and all of these things. And they're not including brain differences in that because they're not aware of it. They don't have the education or the correct terminology. They're just all complete character attacks, including to themselves. So there could be a lot of shame within themselves, not just in between each other. So those two types of sessions are going to be quite different. But in terms of the general format, these couples benefit from clear expectation setting, clear communication, checking in a very direct way without being overbearing, without being arrogant and leading them in any certain way, and without taking away their voice, with giving lots of room for personal expression. We want to be checking in about each partner's level of sensory security. How are they feeling if it's in person? How are they feeling in the room? Are they seated comfortably or standing? Are you giving them the opportunity to tell you for a moment about how much traffic there was? Because if there was a lot of traffic on the way and your neurodivergent or neurotypical partner is coming in with zero spoons already at the start of therapy, and it has nothing to do with the relationship, it's good to clear the air and to speak for a moment about, yes, it is so difficult to deal with the honking horns and the Atlanta traffic, et cetera, et cetera. What would help you to be present in this moment? So there's always a grounding type understanding of the environment. Side note, virtual therapy works amazing with these couples because what more what more could you ask for if they have their dog next to them and they're in the comfort of their own home, if they're seated with their weighted blanket? There is a level of sensory security that is afforded through telehealth that in-person therapy just cannot provide. And so we're checking in at the beginning on a sensory security level because you care about them as people, but also because sensory security is the basis for learning, is the basis for feeling close to your partner. It's very difficult to have any room for emotional intimacy, empathy, etc., if you're so distracted by the smell of the vanilla candle that your counselor has lit because they have an ableist neurotypical mindset that, oh, to me, vanilla is a warm and welcoming scent. I will do this to encourage comfort in my clients. No, that may be the only smell that the client can focus on and is distracting to them, and they're perhaps not feeling empowered enough with the power dynamic and the differential where it's not their home environment. They may not be able to say, excuse me, could you not have that candle going? It's really off-putting or distracting to me. I'm actually feeling nauseous. Or they may not have the interoceptive ability to check in with themselves. They may just feel on edge the whole time and not know why. They may not connect it to the scent of the candle because they might have a difference in processing that. So you may be looking at a client that is uneasy the entire session, and you may assume it's because of the relationship stress. But it may not be. It may be because of your candle. You need to be checking in with your clients about their lived experience in vivo. And also, that applies to telehealth, ensure that their home is comfortable for them. We can't just assume that it is, but it has a higher likelihood to be because they're quote unquote in charge of that environment. So you're checking in there. You're also reviewing the successes that they've had since last visit, because this is so important. Once you've established goals, once you've heard their story, once you have completely joined with the couple, solution focus works so well here. When you can focus on the small incremental victories of how they were able to show empathy to each other, how they were able to identify their own needs, how they were able to face that child's IEP meeting together as a team, et cetera, et cetera. So much of that is important. And then you're modeling skills, you're modeling I statements. You're not just starting out with hold hands and do eye contact and you're going to do speaker listener in this very neurotypical way. No, I really de-emphasize eye contact, actually. And so you're doing great couple therapy with a complete understanding that this couple may get a lot of benefit from texting versus talking, or you're using so much flexibility in how you're coaching your clients to their goals, and you're actually helping them with stressors that are really intense. For example, if they have children, the children are very likely to be neurodivergent, and there could be some extreme challenges there with the children's high support needs, and that puts a lot of strain on the couple. And I know this from experience raising two neurodivergent children myself, one with very high support needs, who it can bite me at times and have challenges attending school and whatnot. And then the other has less support needs. And so there's just a wild difference there with their day-to-day interactions and my experience of motherhood. And so we have to pay attention to how that is affecting the couple and to listen to their stories and jump in a way that helps them not feel so alone. Because if they're neurodiverse parents, they are not having a typical parenting experience. They're just not. And the world is very unforgiving of that. It can be a very isolating journey.
I'm glad you mentioned that too. You said so many wonderful things there, but you mentioned like when we're doing couples work, many times we are going to talk about the co-parental relationship, which if you have a child together, there's a very good chance your child, if you are neurodiverse, even if your partner is neurotypical, your child could have any varying degree of neurodivergent tendencies. So it really works on a number of levels. And what you said, this sensory security check-in, I want to highlight that for our listeners, because you are modeling for, if you check in with the neurodiverse member of the system, not only are you showing kind of respect, you are modeling for the partner how to do it, not to jump to conclusions, how to assume health. So it's a very powerful modeling and alliance builder from the start. In addition to the other thing you told us is reviewing successes and defining what operationalizing what successes look like from a neurodivergent perspective too, and then helping the couple do it. So I'm curious what you've found the essential things in a sensory security check-in, because I think that's one thing all of our listeners today can take and integrate in, no matter if they're working with a couple or individual or family, that sometimes we do things that the candle example resonated with me as I would put that in the waiting room and I would get wildly varying feedback on it. And when I got the feedback from people that didn't, is they were very, yes, sensitive to smells, and those people happen to be neurodivergent. So that one resonated with me a lot. And I was making my clients uncomfortable without even knowing. And the clients that are secure enough will tell you, but sometimes I'm sure there's lots of people that won't because they don't want to offend you, but it does really inhibit their ability to engage with their partner or in therapy with you. So give us the essential things you do in a sensory security check-in.
It's important to know that people may not tell you or offer up information about their personal experience with smells, tastes, touch, the sounds, the light level, the proximity to their partner in the room. If there's only one seating option, that's a big no-no. We have to allow our clients to choose the proximity that they have between you, the counselor, and their partner for a variety of reasons. And we have to allow our clients to get up and walk around. The social schema of driving to a therapy office, walking inside, sitting in a waiting room, perhaps scheduling a new appointment with the receptionist if there's a receptionist, or paying for therapy there, going into the therapist's office. There's so many steps that for a neurotypical brain would just overlook them to say, oh yeah, I went to therapy. But there are many steps. And everything along the way takes energy, decision-making on a very unseen level. And then when you enter this room, it's not your own. It's the therapist's room. And he or she has designed it with you in mind. But most of the time, they've designed it with neurotypical sort of comforts in mind. There's not always, unless the person is well-versed in trauma-informed care or hopefully brain-informed care, or perhaps they work with adolescents and children, there's very often not a little basket of fidget toys. And we say toy, but it doesn't necessarily have to be seen as a toy. This can be something that just relaxes the mind, or it gives a higher level of concentration if you're squeezing on a dough ball or something like that, or if you're playing with a sensory type putty. This can actually give someone's brain greater access to human connection because of a variety of factors. That's just the way the wiring works for some people. And unfortunately, the neurotypical mindset is often that these things can be distracting. And if they are distracting, we don't want to just promote the needs of the neurodivergent person. We also need to pay attention to the neurotypical partner's need. We want to be able to coach the clients to be able to say, I find this helpful, or this is actually not helpful. I like terms like helpful or unhelpful, or this blesses me, or this doesn't bless me, or I'm not sure how I feel about that. I call that the power of the preface, where it's a very good way to coach neurodivergent clients who often can be at a loss of words, or maybe they have too many words. But this power of the preface to say, I'm not sure your reaction to this yet, but here's how I feel. Or I'm not sure how I feel about this, but it's just an icebreaker that gets the words out. And so let's say it is that you're fidgeting uncomfortably in your seat. You're not sure. If the therapist can attune to that, if the therapist can attune to the slight body movements or the way that the client is breathing, and without making a huge deal over it, without making the client feel like a lab rat or something, if they just would say, I noticed your breathing shifted there, or I noticed that you seem to me that that seat might be uncomfortable based on how you're shifting weight. Can you let me know how you're feeling right now in your body? And if that person has a level of interoceptive awareness, this is very difficult for some clients, but if that person has a level of interoceptive awareness, you're then inviting them to check in with themselves to think, is this a comfortable seat for me? Am I able to connect with what's happening around me? or not. And then I like to say something like, what do you think would increase your level of comfort in this room and your level of connection to what's happening here by 10%? Would it be shifting to that seat over here? Would it be my adjusting the blinds? Would it be if your partner turned to you to speak so that you can see their lips moving as they speak? There's so many things that you can just suggest and see if it hits a nerve, pardon the pun. You just put things out there or invite, and you give the person time to consider what would be comfortable for them. And then I love these sessions because sometimes one person is walking around the room and they're fully engaged in the conversation. And let's say the neurotypical partner at first found that incredibly off-putting. You'd be surprised how often a neurotypical person's heart can be just blessed and awakened if they realize, oh, I actually get a more present partner when he's walking around talking to me. They're having to override some messages about that being disrespectful or that being not normal. They have to examine their great need for eye contact or whatever it is, all the books out there that tell you that this is the right way to communicate and just social standards, et cetera, et cetera. But once they realize, oh, this person is fidgeting, this person is walking so that they can connect with me, the power of that connection can then fuel empathy. And if it really truly bothers them, then of course they are allowed to say, that's really distracting to me. I know it helps you, but can we find some sort of compromise? Is there a way that you could look at me sometimes? And then I talk about how I was 30-something before I realized that I never looked anyone in the eyes ever, that I'm always looking at someone's nose or looking at their mouth, and that I've made a career out of communication. And so I coach the neurodivergent person that this might be a great and easy way to bless your partner. Could you just look at their forehead when they talk? Would that be okay? And then we have, again, a win. We're working towards winning for both people. And when you love the person and when the other person is trying to love you, et cetera, and you're trying to work these things out, sometimes these just become so easy, just little tweaks here and there. And they realize, wow, for 5 years, we've been miscommunicating and the answers have been in front of us all this time. We just needed to better understand how we're processing and make these little tweaks. And then we're better prepared to face the really hard stuff, the really big stuff that every couple comes in. But these couples are coming in at a disadvantage because they're getting stuck on the fundamentals of communication, which then doesn't allow them to deal with these other issues that can, again, sometimes be extremely intense. They can be as intense as discrimination and abuse and things that are happening because of their disability. There can be some really intense situations, or again, the parenting situations. There can be some very intense things happening that other couples are not necessarily dealing with. Or maybe they are, but they're not dealing with them in the same way. I'm just thinking that neurotypical parents with neurotypical children are not at a IEP meeting. That's an example that can be extremely stressful. So there are unique neurodivergent or neurodiverse couple experiences that really deserve attention. And if you're not having that foundation of sensory security within the relationship or in the therapy room, you're already at a disadvantage to help them, to join them, to empower them to face their challenges.
You have been a strong advocate for neurodivergence in the MFT space, and your book recently released is a great example of that. I wonder how much you share of your own experience, because therapists vary wildly on how much self-disclosure. If the self-disclosure can normalize, help build an alliance for the client or clients, we believe it would probably be beneficial. However, if it focuses too much on the therapist and detracts from the experience of the individual, or in this case, couple, then that's obviously a constraint and a barrier. I'm curious how you go about sharing or not sharing your own neurodivergent pathway.
Disclosure of one's personal characteristics, of course, is everyone's personal choice. And it is so important for therapists, especially new therapists, to come to an understanding of who they are neurologically and then have an informed decision about how much they share. I would love to see a generation of just unashamed neurodivergent therapists. But again, this is a personal choice. And there are places in the world where it is dangerous to disclose. Discrimination is real. And so just like we don't want to out our clients in any way or encourage them to just shout to the rooftop that they have a different brain when that could be unsafe for them, we really need to consider that and the professional implications. But I find it very powerful to share in my profiles, any place that I'm speaking. I find it very important personally because I identify so much. This is a central characteristic to how I perceive others and the world. I share that I am an ADHDer with autistic traits and sensory processing disorder. These are my neurodivergent characteristics. I am also gifted. And so there's an intensity that comes with this type of profile and just personality base. I love saying all these things because I would hope that it gives people the freedom if they choose to share. Now, that being said, the book shares no personal information about me and my family whatsoever, apart from being dedicated to my children and a short blurb in the introduction, perhaps, and the dedication there. The book is made as a manual for therapists to understand what brain-informed care is, what neurodiversity is. It goes into a deep dive about how to do good, loving therapy, competent therapy. There's assessments and guides and many examples. I have an entire system called brain-informed neurodiverse couple therapy that is outlined to the letter for the stages of how the process of therapy goes. I have exercises. It's not personal at all, but it is coming from a very personal place because I would love for life to be different for the next generation and be part of the wave of training those counselors so that neurodiversity is an ethical standard. We've come a long way in racial understanding, and I would like that to extend, and trauma understanding, and any number of understandings. But I would really like an understanding of neurodiversity to be elevated to an ethical standard of a baseline of competence so that neuroaffirming counselors are not specialists.
If we look back 10 years from now, we check up and follow up on this chat, where do you hope we are as an MFT-specific profession around education and acceptance and advocacy for neurodivergence in family systems, not just couples, we're talking about on a whole family level, as you've spoken about children today, too.
I hope that we would have some finesse in how we walk the line between understanding that these brain neurotypes can truly be disabling. And there's a whole movement in the disabled community to reclaim the term disabled with a capital D. Disability is not a dirty word. And so we have to understand that there is a balance between a toxic positivity mindset of saying neurodiversity, it's a superpower and it's always wonderful. And look at how this advances society and we wouldn't be anywhere without autistic people, except we have to walk the line between celebration, which is appropriate, and also then understanding the day-to-day reality of raising children. I keep going back to that because that's my personal experience, but raising children who have alternate educational paths, who have alternate needs, who communicate through assisted communication devices, for example, for understanding that their life is challenging. And we also need to understand that life doesn't have to be as challenging because some of our ableist assumptions really make it that way, make it harder than it needs to be. So I would hope that there would be more integration of that balance of understanding that there can be high needs at times. And by the way, it fluctuates daily. There can be high needs at times that can be extremely challenging and people can work through all the stages of grief and depression about how hard it is. And there can be a lack of support and all that. And then other times to where there is just autistic joy is a real thing, to where if you've ever seen a child or an adult who is autistic, just as an example, looking at the trees, my son just lights up sometimes when we're in the park and he stops and he looks and he tells me about the Fibonacci sequence that he's seeing in the branches and the joy on his face. It's just amazing. I do believe that different brains were given to this world as a gift that is a very hard gift to steward at times if you are the individual or if you're the parent. And as a community, we need to be better stewards. But it is also very challenging at times, especially the co-occurring conditions. It is a reality that conditions co-occur that can be extremely disabling medically or emotionally. There can be a lot of co-occurring conditions too. So I would like to see the field acknowledge the complexity and not just celebrate that autistics can be great at, I'm going to be stereotypical for a minute, we can't just celebrate that autistics can be great at math. Autistics can build rockets. We don't just need to celebrate or attune the neurotypical partner into all the cool things that their partner can do. We need to not focus on what people are doing necessarily. We need to focus on who people are, who they are, how they interpret the world, how they experience the world, and how can we come alongside and exist in a world that there is no just one standard of correctness. I would really love to see the terms disorder re-examined in our field. I'd really like to see ADHD renamed in particular. We need to have an understanding in the DSM that is much more inclusive of the ups and downs emotionally that people experience. Right now, we have behavioral definitions. We really don't even have great brain definitions in the DSM. We have everything based on behavior, which is measurable, observable, I understand. But I would love to see the definitions reworked in our field so that then the medical model can, which is important at times, the medical model is important at times, but I'd like to see it incorporate more of the social model of disability that is more about the person and the person's environment. And these are changes that I think can have a very profound effect on how we practice marriage and family therapy and how we view people in general. Our manual, our diagnostic manual, is very important to that.
I admire your intelligence, your passion, your conviction for this material. And I know our listeners, after digesting this, will as well. In addition to your book, Neurodiverse Couple Therapy, how can systemic therapists interested in learning more continue the dialogue with you? Because you've given us a lot to think about.
I appreciate that. And that is my most common feedback given, by the way, is that everyone tells me, wow, you've given me so much to think about. And so to go back to your previous question, what would you hope would change in 10 years? I hope people don't have to think so hard. I hope that some of this would be, again, an ethical standard or a level of competence where, to the same degree as trauma-informed therapy has really changed over 20 years or so, and you're seeing that shift also in the way that people are referring to themselves too. Language matters. It's not just word. When people are saying, I'm an autistic person or I'm autistic, that's very different than what was taught 20 years ago of saying person with autism. And so, no, that's a personal choice. Always honor someone's personal choice. But there's more of an identity focus where people are choosing a lot now to understand these parts of themselves and to integrate that into their identity.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. Did you know that AAMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AAMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AAMFT, you can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcasts and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years. You can drop me a line at elikaram.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam,
proven strategies and tips for test taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors, you want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy from Rutledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.
Just